I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. At least five books, two films, and a TV documentary have told the story of what happened on Mount Everest in May 1996. Eight people died, and it would have been nine, but Beck Weathers woke up after 15 hours and was rescued. Today we'll meet Weathers and hear his story, and we'll learn about the opera his Deadly Ascent inspired. Then, Kansas City plays host this weekend to a benefit for the James Beard Foundation's Taste America Scholarship Fund, and it's sort of a big deal. We'll speak with some of the local chefs who are helping cook up a successful event. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. On Mount Everest in May 1996, eight people died in an attempt to summit the highest mountain in the world. This made it the deadliest day in the deadliest year on Everest until 2014. At least five books, two films, and one TV documentary have been created about what happened on the mountain back then, including Jon Krakauer's mega bestseller, In the Thin Air. In 2015, the Dallas Opera added another account with the world premiere of Everest. Now the Lyric Opera of Kansas City will stage the work beginning on Saturday. With us to talk about this production are Dr. Beck Weathers. He's a pathologist, a motivational speaker, and survivor of Mount Everest and that climb we're talking about. He's portrayed in the Lyric Opera's performance of Everest. He joins us from the studios of KERA in Dallas. Dr. Weathers, so nice to have you.
Well, nice to be here. Share the morning with you.
In fact, the person who portrays Beck Weathers is with us now as well. That's Michael Mays. He's a baritone who's making his Lyric Opera debut. And Mike, nice to have you as well.
Yeah, it's an honor to be here.
Beck, let's remind people about your story because it's simply astonishing. You were left for dead on that mountain by two different teams. And then 15 hours later, you woke up. How did that happen? Because it makes no sense.
Well, it doesn't make any sense, and I don't really know how it happens. It is rather a miraculous event because, as we all know, and it's part of the mythology, is that once you go into hypothermic coma in the high mountains, you never wake up. That's no exceptions, and unfortunately, because everybody knows that, they triage you to death. So that once they have ascertained that you are, in fact, in hypothermic coma, rescue efforts cease. And so my particular case, 22 hours in the storm, 15 hours frozen face down on the ice, I managed to open my eyes. And then I had a rather searing vision of my family, and it drove me to my feet. And at that point, I didn't think I was going to get out of there alive, but I had nothing better to do at the time.
How did you get off the mountain, Beck?
Well, first of all, from where I lay out in the South Col, I stood up and walked back alone to the high camp the following day, stood up again, and with the help of a couple of fine mountain guides and the IMAX film crew, I walked the 4,000 vertical feet down the Lhotse face, and the following day we had the world's highest helicopter rescue. Hmm.
Michael Mays, you've met Beck. What did you think? What was your impression?
When I met Beck in Dallas, ever so briefly, we just spoke for a few minutes, but having read, you know, learned his story and seen countless interviews on Google University, because you can find out a lot about people. I was struck by the fact that I was so familiar with him and who he was and the struggles that the struggles that people go through. If you have a similar story, you can sort of feel that resonance.
You relate a lot to him on any number of levels, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
How so?
Well, the struggle that he talks about in his book and we really that's really focused on in the opera about what he calls the black dog depression. You know, that's something I've struggled with my entire life. And I think a lot of people that are in fields that are like this that value achievement, mm-hmm. you sort of do struggle with that. And you know, I had my own problems with suicidal ideation and depression and things. And I like, you know, when I'm talking to people in the cast, we were talking about these characters and things, and I said before that Beck had to go to the top of the world to find his rock bottom, mm-hmm. and I had to go to my rock bottom to even know there was a top of the world. Mm. So,
Beck, how did all this change your life? Because your story, again, is so inspirational. It really flipped you upside down, right?
Well, you would think, looking at this from the outside, that that's a horrible experience, and certainly in many ways, physically, it was difficult. But I had suffered with profound depression for many years and discovered that through extreme exercise, I could basically make that not disappear, but go quiet for a while, and mountaineering turned out to be a perfect outlet for that.
That's why you climbed Mount Everest, right?
Yes, yeah. Along with the, I was pursuing the Seven Summits quest. But when you do that kind of training and go on these long trips and subject yourself to danger, it strains your relationships with the people around you in ways that are almost unbearable to them. And during that time on the mountain, basically my wife decided that she'd had enough. Was ready to divorce me, and she, you know, said wasn't going to do it until I got back to Dallas. And when I walked in the door, she told me that was her decision. And then she turned right around and said, no, I'm going to give you a year to prove to me that you've changed, and Everest changed me. It's a 2x4 across the face, and as a result, I'm a much happier person. My life is on the right track. You wouldn't anticipate that, but good things sometimes come out of horrible circumstances.
Horrible circumstances, Beck, because you lost your hands. Your face had to be reconstructed, right? Because you were lying face down on that ice for as many hours as you said, 15 hours. I mean, that's a big price.
Well, it's a big price, but at the same time, it's just parts. And if you recognize that, okay, I've got some limitations here, but the limitations really only work against you if you allow them to. And I accept my own reality, and I still am working 50 hours a week as a physician here in Dallas. And I'm traveling all over the place and meeting people and enjoying my life. And I can truthfully say that the last years have been the most enjoyable, most fascinating, and challenging of my life.
That's just amazing. Michael, how true to life is this opera that the Lyric Opera is putting on here?
Well, you know, opera is different than other art forms in that it's not there to give you a play-by-play. It's not there to tell you what happened. Opera is there to tell you, not serve as a historical record, but as an emotional record.
Right.
Yeah. And
very
so
well said. Yeah.
That's what this show does. And it's really that, you know, the combination of Joby's skill as a composer, which is incredible. I mean, I listen to a lot of music, but it's rarely opera for pleasure. And I listen to this for pleasure all the time.
Huh.
And the genius of Gene to make this not just an opera based on somebody else's work or some book, but Gene went out and actually went to the sources and talked to people individually. So it serves as sort of another historical source. But rather than telling the facts, it tells the emotional landscape.
Hey, how does a Lyric Opera put the people in the audience? How do you portray the mountain and the ice? And how does that happen?
There's a big... a bunch of 4x4 cubic
yes. I've
blocks.
Seen pictures.
It looks
yeah.
like a close-up of salt crystals being poured down. They're huge. And it, when you walk in, you get this sense of vertigo, especially here in Kansas City as opposed to what they had in Dallas, because it's not as deep.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this like feeling of vertigo. When an audience walks in, the first thing they see is that huge, imposing set, and they hear the sound of radio static. No voices, just static. And it sort of puts them in this, I don't know, this place that's ready to receive this
the radio static, which would signify the mountaineers talking back and forth with their base camp, that kind of thing.
But yeah, but it's an empty channel.
Empty channel, yeah. Right. You know, tell us your story. How did you get to opera? Because you were a country music guy. You're from Texas.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm
you
from
sound,
a little...
You look like Texas. You sound like Texas. How you doing opera?
Yeah, I always say I'm the rootinest, tootinest, opera singinest cowboy you ever did see. You know, bang, 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 bang. And I grew up in a little town outside. I'm sure Beck's probably driven through there a few times outside of Houston called Cut and Shoot, Texas.
Cut and
yeah,
Shoot.
Yeah, it's about 1,000 people. It's basically, when I grew up there, it was a wide spot in the road with about 15 churches.
You know? Yeah.
So I grew up singing gospel, country, and bluegrass music. And in high school, long story short, in high school, I ended up breaking a bunch of fingers playing football. And having grown up in the church singing, yeah, I knew I could sing pretty easy. And with a broken hand, back when we had to take typing class, you couldn't just walk into your typing class with a hand and all bandaged up. So she said, you got to join, do something else. And I could pick either drama or choir. And those theater kids were weirdos. The irony that would pervade the rest of my life, right? So I figured I'd get in choir and get an easy A. And I ended up making All-State and getting scholarships. And I was able to go to college when I couldn't have really gone that on my own. So opera kind of chose me. And it's sort of appeared to me at that, you know, 18, 19, 20 as sort of like the NFL of singing. Because, you know, you can't, there's no hiding in opera. If you have a cold or something goes wrong, there's no hiding. There's no microphones. So
yeah. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date this morning. We're visiting and talking about the Lyric Opera's production of Everest, which opens on Saturday. More information and to purchase tickets, go to kcopera.org. We're visiting with Dr. Beck Weathers, who survived a harrowing hike up on Mount Everest back in 1996, and Mike Mays, a baritone, who's making his Lyric Opera debut, portraying Dr. Weathers in this production. Beck, there have been at least 5 books, 2 films, 1 TV movie, and 1 opera done about this 1996 expedition. What do you make about the fascination over this thing?
Well, those of us who were there had no expectation that anybody would even know anything about this at any point. It's people get injured in the mountains all the time. There were some things that made this stand out, though. One, of course, it is Everest. And secondarily, it was the first story that really broke exclusively on the Internet. And so millions of people followed this in real time with updates from the mountain. But I think the thing that really makes it stand out are the individual stories of the people who were involved, because these were all really fine individuals with real lives and real stories. And so this is a situation which real people make real choices that have real consequences. And every single one of them you get at some level to know as a person, and you feel that tragedy. All of them leave a hole in the lives of others behind them. And, you know, some of the stories, especially the interactions between Rob Hall and his wife Jan, pregnant at 7 months with their first child, are absolutely heartbreaking.
Yeah. You know, when you made your way down that mountain on your own and you got to that first camp and walked in there, when people saw you, you had been taken for dead. What was the reaction?
Well, first of all, they still believed absolutely that I was going to die. And they had no expectation that I'd go any further than just that tent. And as a result, they placed me in the tent alone because, frankly, nobody wanted to participate in what was going to happen. And so they really didn't put out to the rest of the camp that I'd made it back. So they're referring to me as the dead guy in the tent. And it wasn't really till the next day, and they looked in as everybody was leaving and realized I stubbornly hadn't decided to go ahead and do my part, that stood up again, and then we walked out.
Tell us the story when you first woke up on the mountain after having been lying there for 15 hours. You thought you were home in your bed, and then you found out you were not.
I was laying there comfortable, warm, in my own bed, the light streaming to me through the window. And as I opened my eyes, the thing that was directly in front of my face was my gloveless dead hand. And that was a kind of a shock. I took it and I hit it on the ice in a tentative way. And because it was frozen,
it bounced.
Sounded like a block of woods bouncing off the ice. And it had the rather marvelous effect of bringing me back and telling me that I was not in my own bed, because it would have been so easy just to close my eyes again and go back to sleep. But it drove me to my feet, and it kept me moving. And ultimately, by a couple of good choices and a whole lot of luck and some help, I managed to get out of there.
Is it tough for you, Beck, to tell this story to me today and to tell it as many times as you have?
No, it's not difficult at all. You would think that after passage of time that would become more remote, that it would lose its sense of immediacy. But echoing something that Michael said, talking about opera as a medium for emotion and reaching into people's lives, this story is so ingrained in me, and I have such a strong emotional tie to it that I never really get very far from it. And I can say that besides the fact that it's a marvelous work, the opera is pretty spectacular, but it is on an emotional level. I almost can't watch it without, being moved to tears.
You know, I'm wondering, Michael, that moment when Beck wakes up on that mountain and bangs his hand, is that moment portrayed in the opera?
We don't actually bang the hand on the thing, because it's the moment is very fast, and where that happens, you know, he just sort of wakes up and there's this chorus of all of the ghosts of the people who've died on Everest singing, you know, and they're basically beckoning him to join them in their vigil on the mountain as they watch these other people risk their lives every time. And the moment is so quick that to do it, if you did it, it would probably be lost. You wouldn't catch it as an audience member. It's more about him seeing his family. And in the opera, it's represented by this fantastic actress, Claire Rupp, who, when you look into her eyes, when I look into her eyes at one point when she says, "Daddy, where are you, Daddy?" It just sends a lightning bolt through my, because she's so open, this naivete of a child. She looks right into you, as opposed to knowing, you know, to protect you, like you see people. She's just open, and it just wrecks you. And it would be too many things at once, I think.
Had you heard Beck describe that moment before? Because you were reacting to it. I was watching you as Beck was talking, and you were moving and reacting to it.
Yeah. What's great to hear Beck tell the story is that, you know, I've read all kinds of accounts. I've read his book, I've read Ed's book, I've read Krakauer's book, and I've been fascinated with this story. You know, reading Ed Wiestra's books is what caused me to drag my dad up 314ers in Colorado. And now I live in Lyons, Colorado, which I'm sure Beck's familiar with. I'm not on the way to Estes Park. You know, it's just, I don't know.
Beck, were you an opera fan before all this?
Well, I've always loved music, but I must say that I had a rather stilted view of opera, which is, to borrow a phrase from the website, where opera singers would come out, plant themselves in the middle of the stage, and proceed to sing their aria, which is referred to as park and bark. And I was very amused with that. And I was, until I saw modern productions, the recently Moby Dick, with some of the same talent producing that, did I realize just how far this had come. And so these are not just static events. These are like Broadway with film and with projections and with ambience and acting and, of course, the incredible music and the voices. It's moving. It's something that I am going to be there on Saturday to watch again, just simply because I'm, you know, so impressed with it.
Is opera changing, Michael?
Oh, man. I mean, listening to him say what he just said is basically, I mean, this is what I'll talk about when
he's speaking
saying,
to me when I heard him say that.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, this is what he said, that when I saw Everest, when I saw Moby Dick, that I understood the power of this art form to do, et cetera, et cetera. That's exactly what made me become the kind of opera singer that specializes in modern opera, because while I do like La Boheme and Tosca, and I do understand the emotional resonance there, there is nothing that can reach out and grab an audience like contemporary American Verismo opera. Mm-hmm. Opera in our language and our vernacular that speaks to our experience here in this country. When I go out there on a stage and I can actually sing in the audience, and the audience's languages and the words land on them as they're coming out of my mouth, that is the power of this art form. And they're hearing not only the American vernacular in their language, but they're hearing all kind of the vernacular of the music and styles that they understand, as opposed to being something. This, you know, these kinds of works are perfect examples of opera meeting audiences where they are and not expecting them to come to us. And every time I hear a story, when Beck talks about that, that has been my mission in life since I discovered this with Dead Man Walking, with Glory Denied, the story of the longest held POW in American history, Soldier Songs, which is a narrative of combat produced, of multi-generational combat-induced PTSD. These things, when you tell these stories, and we, like, just like when I'm telling Beck's story, they reach out and touch an audience in a way that inspires them often to come to you and say things like, for instance, in Tulsa, a lady came to me and said, "Your portrayal of Joseph Desrochers in Dead Man Walking changed the way I think about the man who murdered my daughter."
Oh, you're kidding. Wow.
Colonel Thompson's daughter gave me his sobriety coin to carry with me for the rest of my life because she was so moved by the performance and said she was able to say farewell to her father before, because she was estranged at his death. So, yeah, I love you, Beck.
Beck, are you going to take questions from the audience on Saturday night?
I always enjoy talking to the audiences. One of the real pleasures of getting out, and for instance, professional speaking, is I like meeting people, and I love that kind of interaction. And if you don't enjoy people, then don't go do that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. You know, Mike, your costume in the opera is made to look like you're wearing full climbing clothes and gear. How do you not overheat during a physical performance like that? I bet you get asked that a lot.
It's not made to look that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's the actual stuff, man.
Oh, is that right?
So, I mean, with a few small thing adjustments, but yeah, it's hot up there, Jack.
Oh, ooh-wee. Man.
Man, we were sweating. I mean, I'm not moving around as much as the other two guys, Andrew Bidlack and Craig Verm playing Doug and Rob. Those guys are rappelling down from the top of the proscenium all the way down to the floor. It's an incredible place. It's really more exerting for them than me because, you know, Beck's story spends a lot of time glued to the ice, you know, so I don't have to move around so much.
Yeah. There's a mountain on stage composed of these jumbled cubes, but you don't scramble around on them very much, it doesn't sound like.
I get from stage left to stage right, which is a challenge, you know, but not impossible.
And because the cubes are white, they're used as a projection screen of sorts. What's shown on them?
Oh, they have these big, I mean, for me, it's hard to see a lot of the things, and but they have a topo map of Everest in the overture. They project what the characters are seeing. For instance, when Beck begins to get his vision back after going blind with his laser keratotomy thing, they have this beautiful sunrise that comes up, and it's just absolutely breathtaking in this projection. And so, the mountain becomes a character in a way, and it reflects a lot of things that are happening.
Beck, what happened to your eyes up on that mountain?
Well, I had radial keratotomy done about a year or so before because I'd had the unfortunate experience of trying to be climbing and coming down and having my glasses just completely covered with ice and I couldn't see. Hmm. And so I had that done, but nobody knew, and I certainly had no knowledge of this, that if you go to very, very high altitudes, there are some individuals that basically have the front of their eye swell. And it's a metabolic effect. It's not a pressure thing, but it is sufficient to lift the images off of your retinas, and so you go effectively blind.
Wow, wow. Well, for you, what was the first sign of trouble on that expedition, Beck? When did you know that things weren't going right?
Well, I was going up the face on the summit push, and I got about halfway up, and then you have to do a traverse to the left, and at that point, my headlamp flickered out, and I was doing okay, planting my feet in the footsteps I could see before me, but it, without the extra light, I really could not see. And I went from fourth in line of 30-something climbers to absolutely dead last until I had to wait until the sun began to come up. And unfortunately, by the time I got up to the balcony of the Summit Ridge area, my vision had not improved sufficiently that I could safely climb, although in retrospect, having my vision cut out on me has probably saved my life.
Hmm. You know, at one point in your recovery, your doctor said they could remove some scars from your face, but you said you didn't want them to, and I'm wondering why.
Well, every day when I get up, I look into that mirror and I see the physical aspect of what occurred to me, and because I see that, I then reflect upon all the non-physical aspects. The physical stuff is the easiest to deal with. It doesn't really affect my life very much. In fact, I just gave it up not too long ago, but after Everest, I decided I'd learn to fly an airplane and I became an instrument-rated commercial pilot. I mean, just you're not really limited if you can put your mind to it, you can figure out how to do almost anything. But I want to look and see that face, and I want to see the scars, and I want to know what I gained and what I lost, and what I gained was a lot more than what I gave up.
Beck, do you ever wake up in the middle of the night and you're back on that mountain again?
That has never bothered me at all. There are a lot of things about Everest that have a huge emotional attachment to, because I can see the people and I can see the place almost as if I were standing there. And that sometimes overwhelms me. But I don't have any sense of loss or tragedy from my own personal viewpoint about Everest. So in many ways, Everest has saved me. So I'm good to go on that.
What's an incredible story. The Lyric Opera production of Everest opens on Saturday. More information and to purchase tickets, go to kcopera.com. Dr. Beck Weathers, thanks so much for your time. We'll look forward to seeing you in Kansas City on Saturday night.
Look forward to it, and we'll get back together, Michael.
Michael Mays, baritone, who portrays Beck Weathers, good luck on Saturday, okay?
You got it,
man. Break a leg, you bet.
All right.
Okay, time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk with chefs about a cool event coming up this weekend. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the program, we heard the stories behind some of the best cover songs of all time, and that was a hoot. Find that conversation at kcur.org and on the NPR One app. Tomorrow, we'll speak with the architect of the Block Building 10 years after its opening, and we'll find out how climate change is creating an epidemic of forest fires. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, you can see top chefs craft delicious dinners on any number of cooking shows, but why do that when you can see top chefs at work and taste the end results? This weekend, the James Beard Taste America Tour is in Kansas City. The James Beard Foundation provides one of its all-star ambassador chefs to collaborate with local chefs in providing a one-of-a-kind benefit dinner and free demonstrations. We'll have more on that in just a few minutes. But first, I want to introduce three local chefs who will be participating in the events tonight and tomorrow. They are Debbie Gold is executive chef at the American and a James Beard Award winner for Best Chef in the Midwestern region. And Debbie, good to have you back again. Welcome.
Thank you for having me again.
Megan Garrels is one of the chef owners, along with her husband Colby, of Rye in Leawood and Blue Stem on Westport Road. She's a 2015 James Beard semifinalist for Outstanding Restaurant in Kansas City. Megan, welcome back to you.
Thank you.
Jonathan Pye is executive chef at the Roselle Court Restaurant at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art and is the host chef for Friday's event. And Jonathan, nice to have you too.
Good morning.
You work at a great place.
Yeah, thank you.
I like it. Well, it was very nice of you all to come over here when you have such a big event to plan for. Jonathan, how many will you have for dinner on Friday?
We're looking at about 335.
335?
Yeah.
That's a crowd.
Yes, it is.
Are you ready?
We're ready. Yeah.
Okay. This is a two-part experience starting with a cocktail and tasting reception. Is everything happening in the Roselle Court, Megan?
Yeah, from what I understand.
It's all going to be there.
Yeah. Might spill out into the halls of the museum. I don't know, with that many people.
Yeah. You have more local chefs creating the tastings for the reception. Who's on hors d'oeuvre duty? Do you know, Debbie?
Well, we were just talking about it, and Jonathan probably knows better than I do.
Jonathan, tell us about that.
We've got Kevin Nashan from St. Louis. He's a James Beard winner. Mm-hmm. Dan Swinney from Lydia's. Ryan Brazil from Novel. Port Fonda, Patrick Ryan.
So this is a big deal.
Yeah, it really is. There's going to be five chefs in Roselle Court and lots of beverage vendors.
Yeah.
So it's going to be a nice party in there.
Egos clashing, or is everyone going to get along okay?
I'm hoping we're all going to get along.
get together like that.
I hope so. I hope we're going to get along, yeah.
It's more about playing,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Is that
yeah.
what it is?
Playing and serving good food.
Yeah.
What do chefs do when they play?
We usually, you know, we hang out, we talk a lot. It's really after the event that it goes on. It can go on all night, so...
Do you do a lot of comparing notes, and have you tried this, tried that? Is it
Yeah,
that kind
you
of
do
thing?
A lot of talking. What'd you do? How'd you do that? You know, it's our way of learning still. You know, once you get a little further along in your career, you're not necessarily just learning. So You ask a lot of questions about how they did something or why they did something, and then we all help each other because we all want the event to be a great event, so we all help each other, make sure it all goes out, and then we sit back and have a couple cocktails afterwards.
Yeah. Megan, you don't know it all yet?
No, no, I don't.
Not quite. You getting closer, though, hopefully?
Well, no, you'll always learn. I mean, for me, I'm not a chef. I'm a pastry chef. So when people cook around, you know, usually my husband does all the cooking at the events. But since I'm doing dessert, it's a little bit more of my forte at this event. So that's good.
Well, Jonathan, you know, for these tastings, are the chefs given a specific challenge or theme, or how does that work?
Not really, no. I think they're it's a free rein. Mm-hmm. They can do whatever they like.
So, yeah. And then it's on to dinner, Debbie. Who's the James Beard All-Star coming to Kansas City? Who is that?
It's Tony Montuano from Chicago. He's executive chef of Spiaggia, and I know he's got his hand in a couple other restaurants as well.
Have you met him before?
He's a friend of mine. I'm originally from Chicago, so I've known him since over, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago now. Yeah, he's great.
What does he do well that just knocks you out?
Everything. Spiaggia is fine dining Italian, and he actually opened the restaurant, and I know he left for a little while and went back, and it's just, he's just very creative, has a great touch with food, and it's a great dining experience.
Can you tell just by watching somebody in the kitchen if they have the right touch or not? Is it something you can just watch someone and see what they've got?
Pretty much. I think when you walk into a kitchen and you watch somebody work, you know how they are, or you know, that's a lot of times why chefs like to see potential cooks in the kitchen, because you can kind of watch them. And it's not necessarily about what they know, but how they handle themselves, how they handle a knife. So you can kind of see it.
Megan, you're nodding your head. You can tell
absolutely.
A lot sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, just, you know, especially with these big events when you're cooking for 300 people, you know, chefs that are experienced, they've been doing this forever. It's experience to pull that off and to do it well, and stay organized and come prepped and ready. And you know, sometimes the younger chefs, they're scrambling around, but everybody here is veterans and knows what they're doing, so it'll be really fun to get together with people like that.
I was going to say, when you're cooking for 335, what's the challenge of that? I mean, that's, how do you focus on each individual plate when it's 335?
Yeah. I think the challenge always is the space. I mean, because you're not in your own kitchen, so you want to be a good guest to your host chef, which is the Nelson, and just make sure everybody has their things together, and just know how you're cooking things, or you know where the freezer's located, or where, you know, how much oven space you're going to have. And it's always a fight to, you know, kind of map out your space so you can pull off your dish.
I was going to say, do good chefs arrive ahead of time? They want to sort of scout it out and see where's where and what's
what. And a lot of the prep gets done in your home restaurant typically, and then you bring it, you know, with you what you can, and then you finish off in the event space. So it's not you're not starting from scratch usually for these things when you walk in the door, which is helpful.
Jonathan, do you have enough room at the Nelson to handle all these people?
We do. We have a good-sized kitchen, and we also, Kirkwood Hall, where the dinner will take place, it seats up to 450 people, so there's ample space.
Yeah. What are the Roselle's kitchen is separated from the dining area. What are the challenges there?
Well, it's a floor below, so we use a freight elevator to get the food upstairs. We have to be at least 10 minutes ahead all the time.
Because it takes that long.
Because it takes that long to get upstairs, yeah.
Yeah.
And get ready.
Well, that sort of changes the dynamic a little bit, doesn't it?
A little bit, yeah. Took me a little while to get used to, but.
So the kitchen's upstairs?
No, it's downstairs.
Downstairs?
Yes.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. And on what floor of the museum is it?
It's on the lobby level.
On the lobby level?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. But you think you got enough room?
Oh, yeah, we're good.
Okay, all right. So it's Tony, Debbie, Megan, and Jonathan. And I want to ask you, Jonathan, about serving a dual role besides cooking that night. You also have to oversee making sure that everyone has everything they need, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what are you going to be cooking, making yourself that night?
I'm doing a raw salmon dish, a crudo, and I'm doing the second course.
The second course, yeah. Mm-hmm. As well as overseeing what everybody else is doing.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. You're like, this is no big deal.
Well, we have.
Are you nervous at all?
A little bit, just because it's James Beard, you know. It's a big deal. So, but we have events for this size pretty regularly, so. I'm just trying to treat it as another event. So
I was going to say, Debbie, the people who come to things like this are pretty particular about what they're eating, right? They know what's good from what's maybe not so good, right?
Yeah, there's an expectation. Like Jonathan said, it's for the James Beard Foundation. So all the chefs kind of want to shine and do, you know, show off the best that they do. And I think the guests that decide to come to these events, they love food, they're interested in food, and it's the ability to get these group of chefs together and have a dinner from all of them where, you know, you can't go to somebody's restaurant generally and have four different chefs cooking for you.
Yeah.
So
does that make you nervous at all, knowing that the audience is a little tougher than ordinary?
No, I mean, I treat every plate, actually, I do the same. I mean, I always want it to shine for whoever eats it. But, the hard part is it's 300 people. So how do you make it taste good, look good, have enough of it to go around? But I've done events up to 3,000 people, tasting events for 3,000. So you kind of figure out your technique and how to execute it.
So I've got to ask, based on what you just said, what if you run out and you've got 15 plates to go? You've done 320, but you got 15 more plates to go. Well, what happens then?
You try not to say too many bad words out loud, and then you go, Jonathan, I need some help. Really, the chefs will get together, and if we know we're in trouble, they'll say, okay, let's see how we can help you. So everybody will get together. It really isn't, it's a friendly kind of competition that night, so we're all there for the same goal, to make it a great event and raise the funds for the James Beard Foundation. So it's really about helping each other.
Well, Megan, what happens? How do you help somebody who's running short of food? What do chefs do? Because you can't snap your fingers and create out of...
Winston's is really close, so we'll run over
just
there.
Just a few blocks away.
I mean, usually you prep an overage. Yeah. So, I mean, if you'll have enough for the guests, and all the chefs usually want to try everybody's course, so... It's kind of, if you're running out, I think you've got bigger problems on an event like this. But, I've never seen that happen in any, large-scale event. Okay. I've seen it happen at my restaurant on regular evenings. We're out of chicken or we're out of this. But, usually for these events, you prep accordingly. We have a firm number, so we're not going to get any walk-ins.
Okay, so you're set there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let me point out the Taste America dinner is set to begin this Friday at 6 o'clock at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. It's sold out, but a waiting list is available through the James Beard Foundation site. We have a link up on our webpage later today to take you to that. Tell me a little more, Jonathan, about what this event is benefiting and who benefits from it.
Well, it benefits the James Beard Foundation and all the programs that they put on throughout the year.
Like what? Tell me what kinds of programs.
Well, there's all kinds of scholarships, and they do all kinds of dinners at the James Beard House. Debbie, you might know more.
Yeah, they're getting more, in a sense, politically active and concerns about sustainability, and they do a food summit now where they bring chefs together and teach them how to get politically active and how do you approach somebody in the government for a specific concern. So they've really kind of done a lot of focusing on how to change the environment in the world and stay green and be sustainable. And
So you're saying the people who are making your food now behind the scenes are also doing politics. The whole world's getting political now,
it
right?
It is. Is that crazy?
People can't stay away from it. Well, it shouldn't be crazy, but that's where we are,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but, there's a lot of waste, and that's a huge concern, and it's unnecessary waste.
Waste of food, you mean?
Waste of food,
at restaurants
definitely.
And at events like this?
Yes. Well, just in general. And, there's a lot of people that go to the grocery store, and if an apple isn't just perfect, they won't go near it. And there's a lot of fruit and vegetables. It doesn't have to look like you see it on a cover of a magazine to still be good.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of education that has to happen.
What does happen at an event like this if there's extra food at the end of an evening for a big event like this? Any idea what's going to happen?
Well, usually events like this one, like Megan said, a lot of the chefs want to eat too. So we'll prepare 30, 40 extra portions and it'll all get eaten. Most of my events, we don't have any waste on the events. It's, it's more the day-to-day running of a restaurant that really where we want to curb the waste.
Megan, what do you do at Rye when you have extra food?
Family meal.
Is that what it is?
Our employees eat a lot, which is good. We want them to. You really try to hit your numbers and hit your pars so that there isn't waste. But, it's inevitable with, things sometimes come in from our vendors that, we'll get a bad case of lettuce and they don't take it back. So then, we got to throw it out or, hopefully they do change it out for you. But there, in some cases, there's things that just happen to waste. You get a freezer that breaks down and you've got to throw. I mean, we had power outage at Blue Stem and that happened a few months ago and we did basically start over at Blue Stem. And it was really sad to see all that prep good. go to trash, but it was all spoiled. So, you know, it happens. You know, it's kind of just the nature of the business. But you do your best to not have waste.
So, Debbie, do you do your best cooking when you're hungry, or do you go in on a full stomach on a typical weekend night? How do you handle that?
No, I'm not usually hungry. You're around food all day and you're tasting things. So, you know, it's more about how you're executing it. And you know, I always tell cooks, when you're making something, if it doesn't make you salivate, it's not going to make anybody else. So you've really got to focus on more about how to make it the best you can. And that, you know,
we graze a lot, too.
Yes.
As chefs.
Y'all wait a
we
lot.
Graze all day. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of chefs don't sit down and have huge meals because they're snacking or they're tasting.
Well, yeah, you can eat five bites and then you're full.
Yeah.
So do you go in hungry or do you go in full?
Do I look hungry? No, I don't think about eating. I just eat. No. I literally eat all day and I don't think about eating when I'm preparing the food. It's just, it's about the food first, and then if I'm hungry, then I'll eat.
You're focused, yeah. I would think going in hungry might be tricky because you'd just be distracted the whole time.
Make you cranky,
yeah. Have any of you ever done one of these America Taste Dinners before, Debbie? Is this a first for you?
I was one of the reception chefs last year, so I did that one.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, more of the dine around at the beginning, and there's, what, five chefs, so... I did that last year, and this year they asked me to be the local star, quote unquote.
Megan, how about you?
Yeah, we did. Blue Stem had I think it was the first or second course last year. Colby did just a raw salmon dish, or not salmon, scallops. But yeah, we were all there in the kitchen plating and helping each other out.
Yeah. Is it a bit of an honor, Jonathan, that Kansas City has been chosen twice for this particular tour?
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
And why have we been chosen twice?
You know, I think we've broken through in the national scene, you know, in the last 10 to 20 years, maybe. And
we've done shows talking about just that point any number of times.
There's some high-quality restaurants, and I think we're being noticed.
Well, didn't it sell out in like 2 days
this year? Sold out quicker than any other James Beard event.
Yes, I believe that was the same last year as well.
Yeah.
What does that say to you?
I think Kansas City knows about the James Beard Foundation and has supported it for a while. And so, and also over, what is it, the last 15, 20 years with all the focus on the food shows and stuff, Kansas City has always been a part of that. And I think they're excited about it. So.
And we're keeping the momentum going, would you say?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the focus has always been on the coast or Chicago, but the middle of the country has a lot to say. St. Louis just won their second James Beard Award last year with Kevin Nashian. Mm-hmm. And Kansas City has, you know, several in town that are Beard winners. So, you know, we're not getting looked over anymore, and they're venturing out. I applaud the James Beard Foundation for getting out of New York City, you know, and going to Chicago and going to the bigger cities and then the smaller cities, too. You know, it's a national effort for food awareness, not only from the education side, but just chefs. I mean, there's chefs in every city. So,
did it take too long for that to happen?
I think so. I mean, you know, there's so much good food in this country. And when you only focus on, you know, New York or, you know, San Francisco, the big cities that typically people think of for food, it's disappointing from the smaller city level because there's a lot of talent around.
Now, on Saturday, Debbie, aren't you doing a free demonstration along with Chef Tony? Can you fill us in a little bit there?
Yeah, it's going to be at Sur La Table in the plaza. And I'm not sure what Tony's doing. I think he's going first. Mine's at noon, and we're just doing a cooking demo
If you can't make it to the meal, then this might be a thing to catch. Yeah,
yeah.
Sur La Table is at, 430 Nichols Road, right?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, okay. If you want to RSVP, requested to reserve your seat, it's a limit of two. Go to jamesbeard.org, and we'll have a link up on our webpage later on this afternoon if you want to check that out. I've looked at the menu here. What was the inspiration for your farmer's egg drop soup, Debbie? What were you thinking there?
Just a good egg drop soup. I love egg drop soup.
And I do, too.
It's like trying to take it to a different level, and you know, it's fun to take what might be considered a classic in any cuisine and try to bring it up a level. And I don't know. I thought it would be fun to make soup for 300. I don't know.
Jonathan, you're doing this fish course that you've mentioned. What is Blue Circle salmon? Because I'm a huge salmon guy. How are you going to be serving it?
Well, Blue Circle is one of the national sponsors. So they're providing me with the salmon.
I see. So how are you going to prepare it?
I'm going to start it today. I'm going to cure it today. And then I'm going to brine it tomorrow. And then I'm going to smoke it lightly on Thursday. And then we're going to serve it raw on Friday.
How many pounds of salmon are you looking at here?
I got 100 in. That's too much, but...
Oh, is it too much?
Oh, yeah.
And it came from Blue Circle. Where do they get their fish?
All over. The fish I'm getting is Norwegian. Mm-hmm. It's all over the world. So,
yeah. And Chef Tony's doing this duck dish. Uh-huh. And there are wine or spirit pairings with each course. Mm-hmm. Who picks those?
The James Beard Foundation picks those.
They don't mess around with that then, eh?
No.
Yeah, okay. Again, this is a benefit event for the James Beard Foundation's Taste America Scholarship Fund. And this is important stuff, right, Debbie?
Oh, yeah. The James Foundation, I think James Beard Foundation was one of the first foundations developed that sort of celebrated the hospitality industry from front of the house to back of the house to, you know, the writers, the journalists. And like I said, now they're kind of moving on and getting more politically involved. And they do great work. It's a great organization.
Again, the Taste America dinner set to begin this Friday at 6 at the Nelson Atkins is sold out, but a waiting list is available through the James Beard Foundation site. We'll put a link up on our webpage later today. You're probably hungry after listening to this conversation like I am. You can check that out later on today. Debbie Gold, executive chef at The American, thanks so much for coming back.
Thanks for having me.
Megan Geraltz, one of the chef owners, along with her husband Colby of Rye in Leawood and Blue Stem on Westport Road. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And Jonathan Pye, executive chef at the Roselle Court Restaurant at the Nelson Atkins. Good luck this weekend.
Thank you.
Okay. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. On tomorrow's show, an interview with the architect of the Block Building 10 years after its opening, and we'll learn about the changing nature of forest fires. Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Justin Garnett produced this show. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.